Session number 24573, Real One.
Mr. Michael Darcy, Real One. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Darcy?
Yes, I was born in London on the 5th of May, 1923.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background and what your father did for a living, your mother?
Well, I would say that we were probably what you would regard as a middle-class family. My father was the first, at one time, the chairman, and then when the companies changed, the general manager of a tobacco manufacturing company, the name of which doesn't exist now, but it was very well known at the time. They were called Abdullah, which then became part of the Godfrey Phillips group of tobacco manufacturing companies, and then the name has subsequently been lost altogether. But he had a very good job with them. He'd been with them since, I think, before the First World War started. He was with them until he eventually had a stroke and had to retire from business altogether.
Had he fought in the First World War?
He was in the army, but he wasn't at the front. He was in what I believe was known as the Judge Advocates Department. And he was concerned with prosecuting people who were trying to evade military service. And as a result of all that, he got an MBE at the end of the First World War.
And what about, how many were there in the family?
My father and mother, of course, and my elder brother, Patrick, and myself. He was 9 years older than me. He was born in 1914. And he was, well, obviously, the big brother all through my young life.
So it was a fairly comfortable upbringing. Which part of London were you living in?
I was born and we lived in St. John's Wood, in Clifton Hill in St. John's Wood.
And what about your education? Tell us a bit about
that. Well, it was the usual thing. My brother had the usual prep school education, followed by public school education. He'd been to Douay College, which was one of the public schools at that time. I think they still exist. Anyway, I started, as usual, at a prep school in Hampstead. It was a school called Gaveney House, and it was one of many fairly good prep schools that existed in the Hampstead region of London. I was there until the age probably of about 9 or 10. And at that stage, my father had a stroke. And everything, the wheel came off, as the saying goes. Everything went wrong from that point onwards. He was never able to work again. He got better to the point where he could walk and he could speak and so on and so forth, but there was never any question of him going back to business. So the job disappeared, and the income that went with it largely disappeared, and the remaining funds that my mother and father had certainly were not sufficient to even consider the idea of me going on to public school. So that had to be dropped completely. So, at the age of about 10, as I say, I left Gaveney House and I was sent to a boarding school down in a place called March in Cambridgeshire. I think the idea was to get me away from the house while my father was in the throes of his stroke and illness and all the rest of it. They didn't want me around the place, I think. So I went to this boarding school in March for about 2 years. It was a strange school, a very weird arrangement. It was run by the local parish priest, and the school existed in what was called the presbytery, the priest's house. And there were only about 10 boys in the whole school. It was an extraordinary situation, really and truly. But anyway, I was there for a couple of years, and at the end of it, they brought me back to London. Apparently, I think things had settled down a bit. And they were able to send me to another prep school in London called York House, which was also in Hampstead. And I stayed there until I was 14, and then I'm afraid the money ran out. So there was no question of any further schooling or education of any sort, type or description. So I did what millions of young boys did in those days. I went to work.
That would be in 1937. How had you done at school? I mean, you know,
I'd done fairly well. I'd got prizes for this and that and the other, and I suppose I did reasonably well. I never got any bad reports that I can remember.
Any particular favourite subjects or things you were good at?
I used to like French, and I liked history. I never liked algebra. I could get on all right with arithmetic and geometry, because that always seemed fairly logical to me, but algebra was really a foreign language and I didn't like it at all.
What about sport?
Sport, average, nothing special. I played soccer and I played cricket, and I went to the gymnasium a couple of times a week for gym, and I did swimming in the summer and all the usual things, but I was never a sporting star of any sort.
Was there an OTC or...
No, these schools were much too small.
Of course, so I'm into local...
I beg your pardon.
But, you know...
No, I never had any dealings with that sort of thing.
And were you in... Did you have any hobbies like Scouts or anything like that?
No, never liked the Boy Scouts at all.
And why not?
I don't know. They always seem to me to be a funny mob.
In what way?
Well, with their sticks and their knots and their woggles and things like that, it always struck me as being a bit odd. And I never wanted to have anything to do with it, really, at all.
Did you have any big hobbies or interests?
No, not really. And, of course, I never, apart from stamp collecting. And when I reached the age of 14 and had to go to work, then I'm afraid everything changed and life changed completely.
Now, what work did you go to, and how were you put
well,
into
it? Well, what happened was, I left school in the summer of 1937, and my mother and I agreed that I was to find a job, and I found an advert in the paper for an office boy required for a publishing company in the West End of London, and I wrote off, and I got an interview, and I went down, and I got the job, and this was a company called Leonard Hill Limited, who were technical publishers. They published magazines on things like food manufacturing and chemical manufacturing and paint and various sorts of technical subjects. And I worked for them.
What were your basic duties as an office boy?
I was the office boy. The general dog's body did all the mail, the distribution of mail, all the franking of mail, the wrapping of parcels, running errands for the management of all sorts and descriptions. I used to have to go round the other big publishing companies once a week with a great big suitcase, buying books that people had ordered, and I used to have to get them from the trade counters of these other publishing firms. That sort of thing. And it was quite interesting up to a point. But bear in mind, I was 14 and just a kid.
How long were you doing that for?
I did that, getting slightly more responsible work after a year or so, but then on Friday the 1st of September 1939, the Germans walked into Poland, and I never went back to the office again. I went straight from the office that evening to the headquarters of the ARP department in St. Marylebone in Baker Street, and offered my services in whatever capacity I could be of use. And they took me on as what they called a messenger cum something else. I can't remember what it was.
And were you actually employed by them?
Indeed. I never went back to the office. And my own office, that is to say. I rang them up on the Monday morning, because by then war had been declared. The Germans walked into Poland on the Friday. Chamberlain declared war on the Sunday. And I rang the office on Monday to tell them that I'm very sorry, I'm not coming back.
Now, what do you remember of the actual outbreak of war and how you felt?
I remember it quite well. We were in the office at in the Baker Street offices of the ARP, where people were coming in a constant stream for advice and information. And there was a woman called Mrs. Flanagan, I recall, who was running the office at that time, and she was an absolute marvel, the way she dealt with all these inquiries that people came with. And I was being dashed around from here to there on my bicycle, being sent to various wardens' posts and to the control centre and back and forth with messages of every type and description. It was a busy time. And when everybody stopped to listen to Chamberlain on the radio, making his speech, which we all know about, there was a sort of a... Everyone looked at each other as much as to say, oh, my God, that's Tornet, you know. And, of course, within a quarter of an hour, the air raid sirens sounded. Within a quarter of an hour of war being declared, the alarm, the warning sounded in London, and nobody knew what the hell to do. It was all very chaotic. But eventually it all settled down, and life settled into a sort of a pattern.
Now, you were based at the headquarters, you said?
Yes, that was in Baker Street in London. I think the number was 128 Baker Street, if I remember correctly. And then...
Now, what exactly were you doing? What were your typical duties?
Well, typical duties were taking messages. They were very concerned about the fact that in the event of heavy bombing, the telephone system would break down, as it probably would, and very easily could. And so they had a number of blokes like myself operating at various points around the borough who would carry messages from one place to another to get orders and information back and forth around the system in the event of telephones not working. So this was being done on a regular basis now with me and with the other lads who are in other warden's posts and things around the place. And it was all done on a practice basis. Messages were being sent that would normally be telephoned. So I was very busy dashing around hither and thon all over the shop.
Did you use a bicycle or...?
Yes, the bicycle. Yes, my own bike. I had my own bike and I used that.
Were there any other duties you had?
Not at that stage, but because after literally 2 or 3 weeks of this, I was transferred... from the office in Baker Street to what was known as the Report and Control Centre.
Now, where was that at?
Now, this was located in the Marylebone Town Hall in the basement of the new library building that had just been built and was not yet in use even as a library. But it was a brand new concrete building alongside the town hall. And the Report and Control Centre was down in the basement of this building, and the whole nerve centre of air raid control was held in that place. There was a controller, there were various officers concerned with the distribution of fire engines, fire pumps, rescue vehicles, and all sorts of things, and information as to where every vehicle was, and so it could be allocated to go from one place to another place in the event of an incident taking place, and so on and so forth. And this was all controlled from this place. So it was a very secure place. And one of the things that I and two or three other young chaps had to do was act as sort of security guards, apart from everything else, apart from the messages. We had to make sure that nobody got into the place who wasn't entitled to be there. And it was quite a big place with a whole batch of girls on telephones, and there were chaps with wall charts and the little tabs that they hung on hooks and all sorts of things. It was all very, very efficiently organised. And that's where I went, and that's where I spent then the next over 12 months.
So sort of late September through to September 14th?
Yes, until October, actually. I was there right through the early part of the Blitz when there were bombs dropping all over the shop and we were rushing around on our bicycles, with messages.
Perhaps we'll just step back from that a little.
Yeah.
What about the actual air raid precautions that happened in your own home? Let's say if we look at that, then we'll look at... Because, you know, during the quiet part of the war...
Yes, that's right.
Did you have any shelters?
Yes, there was a what they called an Anderson shelter in the garden. Because we weren't, at that stage, we long since left our home in Clifton Hill. We couldn't afford that. That was all gone and finished. We were living in a flat, just my mother and I.
Whereabouts?
In St. John's Wood again, in Alexandra Road. My father had gone to Ireland, My mother and father were originally Irish people, if you should understand. And my father, who was really a very ill man and wasn't capable of doing very much at all, he wanted to be back among his family. And he'd gone to Ireland, and he'd gone there just before the war started, and there was grave difficulty in any chance of getting him back after the war had started. My brother had gone into the Air Force and was away. So there were just my mother and myself. We were living in this flat in Alexandra Road, and there was this Anderson shelter in the back garden.
Now, who put that in there? Was that you?
Well, no, I didn't do it. I certainly didn't do it, and I'm trying to remember who did. I think the people who had the garden flat in this house. I think either they had done it or the council had done it for them. I'm not sure which.
Now, what was it like in there?
Horrible, really. They were sort of sunk into the ground, these Anderson shelters. They were like an arch type roof of corrugated metal. And it was sunk 2 or 3 feet into the ground, so you had to sort of go down a step or two from the garden level to get into it. And it was damp and cold and rather miserable, and people used to sit in there wrapped in blankets and with candles and things like that. And in the better weather, if you were that way inclined, a lot of people used to play cards all night in the Anderson shelters. And the kids used to sleep in there, and they were horrible things, really. But I suppose they saved a lot of lives from falling debris, apart from direct hits or anything like that. They wouldn't stand a direct hit. But at least if you were in there with your family and your friends, you could have lumps of shrapnel or slates or bricks fall on you without doing any damage. You know.
Now, any other shelters you or your family used?
I never did. The only other shelter in the home that I ever saw was a thing called a Morrison shelter.
Can you explain what that was?
Which basically was a square or possibly rectangular table made of steel, with a steel top and steel legs. And I think the idea was that you just got underneath and hope for the best.
Now, what about the blackout? How was that done in your?
The blackout was just the normal thing. You got this black material. I mean, I didn't do it. My mother did it. I can't remember the details, but I know she. I think she lined the curtains in the bedroom and the lounge and so on with this black material, and made sure that it completely overlapped and covered the window when it was dark.
What was it like outside during?
Pardon me. Not very nice. It was very completely dark, of course. Everyone was trying to get torches, which got to be in very short supply. And you had a thing called a number 8 battery. I remember everyone was madly trying to get hold of number 8 batteries for these torches to enable you to get around the place, you know. Yeah.
How did rationing affect you? Food, clothing, any other sort?
Well, you must remember, I was only 16. And as long as I had some nice doorstep sandwiches of cheese or corned beef or, I don't know, something like that, I was quite happy. And I never felt that I was short of food. Never.
Clothes?
Again, at that age, I wasn't too concerned. I mean, it wasn't like things are today where all these children are fashion conscious. It just didn't arise.
Now, so what events do you remember from the time? I mean, you know, well, there's a phony war first.
Phony war went on, and as far as work was concerned at that time, pardon me, we were doing, oh, thanks for that. We were doing 16-hour shifts. We used to go on shift at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and come off at 8 o'clock the following morning. And the day shift, which was another lot, they were on from 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. They were on every day from 8 till 4. And the 16-hour people were alternate days. There were two lots of them. So we were on from 4 till 8 one day, and the next lot were on from 4 till 8 the day after. But the day shift people were on every day, from 8 till 4. And the time was spent in exercising. All sorts of scenarios were dreamed up, and fire engines and trailer pumps and ambulances and salvage vehicles were being sent all over the place to go here and go there and rescue people and this and it was very efficient, really. At least I think it was. And speaking as a kid at that time, I think it was quite good.
And so you were endlessly practicing during the phony war, essentially.
That's right. Then of course, the bombing started. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was in the summer of 1940, sometime. It started, and these blokes, these Germans, used to come over and drop bombs all over the shop. Now, we had some terrible bombing incidents in St. Marylebone, some really dreadful ones, where large numbers of people were killed with shelters receiving direct hits and so on and so forth. And it was pretty, what you might call, hairy.
Now, what do you remember of this period? What any incidents you recall?
Yes, the thing I remember was I was standing outside the control centre one evening on guard duty, and we were just along the road from Madame Tussauds, which is further along Marylebone Road from us, and a landmine went off down there, and I was standing probably, I must have been 400 yards away at the very least, and it lifted me off my feet and threw me against a wall beside me. Though I've never an experience, I've never had anything like that in my life before. It just lifted me up and flung me against the wall. It didn't hurt me, but a very strange experience. And that killed a few people, but there were bombs all over the shop.
So you'd be in between. You'd be doing guard duties
and message duties. And then when we weren't
doing, did they actually have to use you as messages? I mean, did
no? In fact, the telephone system held up well enough that they never actually had to use us for that originally intended purpose. So it was okay. And
be largely on the guard duties.
Well, basically, it was there were about three or four of us. There, a fella called Freddie Little, another guy called Nichols, I can't remember his first name, another one called Stroud, boy called Stroud, and a man called Hopkins, who had a withered arm, and he was a town hall employee, and he was supposed to be in charge of us, as far as I can remember, although that didn't really mean a thing. The thing was that when there was no bombing going on, and no actual training incidents going on, we used to sit and play cards all night. I mean, quite literally, we'd sit and play solo for hours and hours and hours on end when nothing else was happening.
Would you gamble, or was it just playing?
Oh, just playing a farthing a point. We used to play with tiddlywinks. That was the coinage we used, and a tiddlywink was worth a farthing. So it didn't matter. You could play all night and win a half couple of bob. Or lose it.
any instance you recall? So you were basically guarding the
report and control centre. Yeah, that's
right. Did you have any weapons or?
No, nothing like that at all. It always surprised me that they didn't give us anything at all. And I remember bringing an Indian club with me. I had some Indian clubs at home, and I thought I'll take that to work with me and have that nearby when I'm standing guard. I used to have this thing there. Yeah, the old Indian club. But anyway, this went on.
You didn't have to attend the scene of these incidents locally, though.
No, that was never part of my job. That was done by the wardens. There were wardens' posts all over the boroughs, all over the borough. And we had to know every warden's post and where it was so that we could go ride quickly to any one of them and from one to another and all the rest of it with information and orders and instructions or whatever. But they together with the fire brigade people and the police and the heavy rescue boys and the light rescue boys, they actually attended the incidents. That wasn't part of my job.
So the next thing is really, what's the next thing you remember happening? You know, after the German real raid started late summer.
That's right.
Or early autumn.
In the summer, and they went on for quite a long time. I can't remember how long. But then it quietened down again. And when it quietened down, a friend of mine, a chap I'd known since I was all my life, a boy I'd grown up with. He was at that time working for a company in London called the Consolidated Pneumatic Tool Company. And he was going into the Air Force because he was about 6 months older than I was. And I was 17 or thereabouts. I know he was near enough 18. He was going into the Air Force. And the people at his office had said to him, John, is it possible that you could find somebody to take your job when you go off into the Air Force? So he came to me and asked me if I'd like to go and work for this company. And being a very feckless, I mean, after all, 16 or 17, you're a bit stupid. I thought, well, yeah, I'll do the bloke a favour. He wants me to take his job, I'll take his job. So I deliberately set off down and saw these people in Fulham. And in, I had an interview, and they said, right, well, will you take the job? And I said, yes, I'll take it. It was, again, a sort of rather glorified office boy, not quite the junior of the office, but a little bit up from that. And I said, yes, sure, I'll start, and I'll work for you. So I went back to the ARP people and said, well, I'm leaving. I'll give you a week's notice. I'm going at the end of the week, which I did. So in October the 12th, I seem to think it was, 1940, I started work for Consolidated Pneumatic Tool Company. I think I'll call them CPT from now onwards. It's much easier. And I worked in the office there. They were people who manufactured air compressors and power tools of every sort and type. They were the subsidiary of an American company called the Chicago Pneumatic Tool Company. And they manufactured in Scotland. They manufactured in a place called Fraserburgh, up in the northeast of Scotland. And I went to work in the head office, which was in Fulham, in London, in Dawes Road, Fulham. And after a little while, they got me relieving on the switchboard. The lady who ran the switchboard, they used to get me to go and run the switchboard when she'd gone for her lunch or for a break of any sort. Apparently, I ran this switchboard very well. It was a great big double board, and apparently I was able to handle it. They used to reckon I handled it like a piano player. I know it's a strange expression, but that's what they used to say. Anyway, after about 3 months, two or three months of working for these people, I was told in the office, that the whole of the head office organisation was being transferred from London up to Fraserburgh in order to get away from the bombing and so to keep the organisation intact. And would I like to be one of those who was evacuated to Fraserburgh? Well, now, again, I was a young bloke. I thought the whole was a very nice idea to be going up to the north of Scotland, which I'd never seen in my life. And my mother didn't mind. I mean, I was healthy and fit, and she said, well, yeah, if you want to go, you go. So anyway, I said yes, and so they sent me off there to Fraserburgh, ostensibly to teach a local girl up there how to handle a big double switchboard which was being installed in the new head office building outside Fraserburgh. What they had done, they'd taken a great big mansion called Caerness House, which belonged, I believe, to the Countess of South Esk or some peculiar Scottish title. And this was going to be converted to head office.